All right, now we're back here. We're back in the batch, and we got this batch in the new place. Now, in the Japanese, we had to fill out papers on on our little Sunday morning meetings. We had our Sunday morning meetings. Got to fill out papers. Who attended? What the subject was? How much the collection was? And all of this. Well, you can imagine, those papers didn't get filled out. Part of it didn't get filled out, and they couldn't understand why there was never anything on the collection business. So they came down, and finally they came and they sat in our meetings to see what was going on. And they saw no collection taken. So then they couldn't figure it out. Then they came to the house, and they were talking Japanese. I didn't know what they were saying. And looking out at the garden, all the garden, and they finally decided that we lived off of the garden. And then they went away, and they didn't bother us anymore. That was okay then. All right, now maybe we should jump up to 1940. Let's see, the fall of 1943, we had two big typhoons, 5 foot of water in the streets of Manila. And people going up and down the streets in these dugout bunkas, we call them bunka. And that's the way you had to get up down the streets. It was just the water level raised 5 feet in the street. And so it was a mess. This marked a change in the value of the Japanese invasion money. Their money fell by 50%. That is, it was worth only half its value after that flood. Somehow or other, it affected the psychology of the people, and they just had the feeling that the Japanese are going to lose this thing. So, okay. And from then on, that's the way it went. Well, in 44 then, I'm going to try to push along here. In 44, I got my weight back, and I was strong again and feeling my oats, I suppose, some. And one day, I decided I'm going to try to go out and visit our friends that are out in the Pinagkaisahan area. Now, this was outside the city of Manila, and we were not supposed to go out there. We were forbidden to go out there. We had to wear a red armband and had Japanese printing on it. Don't know what it said. Wherever we went, we had to wear that Japanese armband. That was law. But I decided I'm going out to see those folks out at Pinagkaisahan. And so, all right. This Sunday morning, I got on my bicycle. Now, I knew that we were just next to the fields, that is the rice fields, and that to go out to Pinagkaisahan, I had to cross those rice fields through the country until I come to Pinagkaisahan. Now, halfway out there, the Japanese were building a new airport. And this was called Nielsen Field, I think that was what they called it. And I had to go past that airport. And I knew that it was a kind of a precarious thing, and you're not supposed to go by that airport. You're not supposed to go around it. They didn't want anybody around it. Well, anyway, I decided I'd go out there. Well, I went out there, and here's this barbed wire fence, 8 foot high, all around the airport. And they were using American labor prisoners to do the work. And it was pick and shovel and wheelbarrow, and they had no bulldozer or anything like that. It was all just handwork. And then I went down to the corner, and I could look up there for a mile or mile and a quarter or so, and about halfway, there was a guardhouse, and then there were barracks where the men slept, and the Japanese too. And I could see a guard standing down there at the far end. That is at the halfway mark. They had a little shed where he could stand in the shade. And I knew I'd have to go by that, and there was a sign here on sawhorses across the road that says, "Positively, no trespassing." Positively, no trespassing. Well, I thought maybe I could, if I just rode down here on my bicycle, maybe I could talk them out of it. So I decided I'll try it. So I got on my bicycle and I rode down there, and I knew very well that he'll stop me. And I'm ready to stop. I'm not going to try to go by a fellow that's got a gun with a bayonet on it and try to just go ignore him. I've got to stop. So all right. I rode down there to this fella, little Japanese, and oh boy, he was insistent that I stop. All right, I stop. And I don't know, he told me mostly by sign because he didn't know much English. But anyway, one thing he did do, he told me, he says, "This road no go, this road no go, this road no go." And I pretended I couldn't understand him. And I talked to him, and I told him, "I want to go out this way. I'm going out here to a place out here, and this is where I want to go. I want to go out this way." And he just kept on telling me, "This road no go." And I just kept talking and talking and talking to him, telling him, "I want to go out this way. I want to go out that way, out that way." And he kept telling me, this road no go. And I just kept talking to him. I figured I'd just wear him down. And finally, you know, he didn't know what in the world to do with me. He just didn't have any idea what to do with me. And he argued there, but of course I didn't. Couldn't talk English. And I kept telling him I wanted to go out this way. And finally he got an idea in his head. He pointed out the road. He says, house? I said, yeah, house. Well, of course, what he meant was home. Well, I didn't make any difference to me. Any way to get out there. He says, house. I said, yeah, house. Okay. So he let me go. Okay, all right. I knew I'd have to come back, but I was hoping they'd change the guard before I get back. So I went riding out there. I could see these American fellas out there in the field working, but they were out there. The meeting starts at 9 o'clock over there, so I wanted to be there by 9. And this was early in the morning. They were out there already working. And I rode on out to the meeting place, and oh, we had a nice meeting, and all the folks were so happy to see one of the workers. They hadn't seen a worker since the war started, and this is in 1944 now. And we just had and most of these folks, a lot of the men in that place area were in the what's called Philippine Scouts. That was a branch of the U.S. military. And here we had our meeting, and then they got lunch for me, and I had a nice lunch, and then I had a siesta, and then after the siesta, I had a merienda, and I was having a real nice time with them, but in the back of my mind all the time is this guard down there, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I know one thing, I've got to go back, I've got to face the music, I got to do it sooner or later, so what happened, I finally told him, bid him goodbye. I didn't tell him any of my troubles. Didn't tell him a thing about what had happened or how hard it was to get there. Not a thing. I didn't tell him a thing. I just headed back. Okay, I come down to the corner of the airport, and here's these guys now. I didn't leave until about 5 o'clock. Maybe it was after 5. I knew that pretty quick it'd get dark, and I must not be out after dark. So I rode down there, and here were these fellas now coming in from the field, and Americans. And they were headed for their barracks. And I figured, well, I'll just let them know I'm an American. And it was way down there to the guardhouse yet, so I whistled, God bless America. I just whistled, God bless America, and rode along there on my bicycle whistling, God bless America. And, of course, they'd know that didn't come from a Japanese. And then I got down to where I figured I better cut it off now. I'm coming down to this guardhouse again. And I sure hope they've changed the guard. And I come riding up there. And when I got up to where I could see, why, he's the same guy as there in the morning. Man, I had hoped they'd changed the guard by that time. But they hadn't changed the guard. And man, was he was not going to let me by. No matter what, he wasn't going to let me by. Well, I started in on him again. And I talked to him and told him, now I'm going this way. And I the word house had got me by before, so I told him house and I pointed this direction. And I figured he'll figure that guy's all mixed up. He don't know where he's going. But anyway, he'll be so confused he won't know what to do with me and he'll turn me loose. So I just kept talking to him and talking to him and talking to him. And you know, pretty quick, he was absolutely so frustrated he didn't know what to do. And finally, he made signs that I was to stand right there and I was not to move. And he went off into the barracks. I knew what he was going after. He's going after somebody that's got more authority than he has. He's going to bring him out here and he'll convince me that I've got to go back. And he'll be free of the responsibility. So, all right. He goes in there and he brings out a little officer. And this officer comes walking out there just dressed spick and span and neat as a pin. And he said, this road no go. And I began to give him my spiel about going down this road and so on. I told him the same thing I told the other, and he kept telling me this road no go. And I just continued to talk to him and tell him about this. And, you know, in the meantime, here these American soldiers came up, and they come up to as close as that bench is that you're leaning on there, right behind the Japanese soldier, the Japanese, this officer. And you know there wasn't one wisecrack, not one smart remark out of one of those Americans. They were prisoners. And they weren't making any smart remarks. And they were just there to listen and to watch and to see what was going on. They were observing. And you'd be sure that they weren't going to do anything. They just listened. And they'd probably figure they might pick up a little information. Well, I I figured that'd be a good idea too, if I could give him any. Well, now then, I continued talking to this Japanese, and he was absolutely wouldn't let me go by. But then finally, he just got frustrated like the other fellow. He was so frustrated, he didn't know what to do with it. Now this other Japanese, he's standing back. He's just standing back there, and he's letting this fellow handle it. Not his job any longer, it's the other fellow's job. And so finally, this little Japanese, all right, he told me he would let me go. He'd let me go. But he wanted me to know this road, no go. Okay. Then he turned to these soldiers that were standing behind him. He says, American soldier. He says, good treatment. American soldier, good treatment. I says, that's good. I says, you give them good treatment. I says, yeah, that's good. And so he's telling me this, and he told me already that he would let me go now. And I decided I'm going to talk to those guys, and he won't know the difference. So I turned right to him, just facing him, just right square on. And I began to talking real fast. And I told him I was an American missionary. I was interned in Santa Tomas internment camp. And they turned all the American missionaries out. We live in Pasay. And this morning I went out here to Pinagdesan to go to church. And now I'm on my way back home. And I told him just about everything I had to tell him. And the sweat was coming out on the back of my neck. And my hair is almost standing up. And I had said just about as much as I could say. And during that time, it was the funniest thing. He thought I was honoring him, you see, because I was talking to him. I was talking right directly to him. He thought I was honoring him, and he didn't know the difference. He didn't know what I was saying. I was talking fast. I did it on purpose. And so he bowed. It was a tight spot, but I was getting through. I tell you, the Lord had something to do with it. and when I tell you, the sweat was breaking out on me, and so I told him, thank you, I will go now. And so I got on my bike, and these guys were lining the fence up there for 100 yards, standing up next to the fence, and not a one of them said a word. And I didn't turn my head. I just rode down that fence line. I didn't turn my head right or left. I just went right straight down the fence line. And I think maybe you'll believe me, I didn't come back again. That was an only trip. Well, I think the Lord was good to some people because they don't have brains enough to take care of themselves. I got away with it. Well, then, a little later on, I decided I'd sell my bicycle. The Chinese were offering tremendous prices for bicycles because bicycles were transportation. And, you know, there had been no gasoline for cars or anything like that. And in the meantime, they'd brought horses in and they'd taken the frames, they'd taken the engines out of cars and made buses out of them. That is, bus, so to speak, and were pulling them with horses. And this is the transportation in Manila. Then if they could get a bicycle, they'd turn it into a kind of a tricycle deal, and they'd charge, and they'd haul passengers with that and make money, pedicabs. Well, they were after my bicycle, and they offered me prices, and I didn't want to sell it. Finally, I decided maybe I had a sneaking idea. Maybe I'd better sell this. I didn't really know why I was being moved to sell it. I'd better sell it. So I thought, well, I'll set the price plenty high. And Chinese made me an offer on it of a certain amount, and I raised it way up above his offer. And I said, I'll tell you, the bicycle cost about 15 pesos in the beginning. That's $7.50. It was an old bicycle, but I'd fixed it up so it was a pretty good bicycle. But now then, they were offering me 100, 150 pesos for it. And, they're wanting it real badly, so I just took, and I says, 300 pesos. Okay. I says, look, not 300 pesos Japanese occupation money, 300 pesos real money. Well, that meant 300 pesos that was used by the Americans in the Philippine Islands before the war started. Okay. That's $150 for that old $7 bicycle. Well, I got my price. I got my price. Well, then what to do with the money? You see, if I was caught with that money, they'd say that this man was connected with the underground somehow or other. And I'd get into trouble with the Japanese for sure. They'd accuse me of being connected with the underground. So I got a little, it was a cod liver oil, McCoy's cod liver oil bottle. They were made of celluloid. They didn't used to have plastic like they have now, celluloid. But it looked just like plastic. It was about that long, about so big around. And it had a little metal cap on it. And I took that, and I put a little cotton in the bottom, because the cotton, the bottom of it was clear. I put a little cotton in the bottom. Then I filled it up about halfway with soda tablets. Then I put a little cotton on top of that. And then I put these peso bills in there. And it was a tube about so long. And I put the peso bills in first, and then the tablets on top. I got it backwards here. The tablets on top, the peso bills in the bottom. Okay, now this is disguised real well. It's got tablets there, and you wouldn't know that it had pesos underneath. So, okay. Well, now then, we'll just leave that little story. Then, about the 1st of July, this is 1944, I went down to Louis Leriche to get a haircut, and he used to always cut my hair. And so he cut my hair for me. Look, I says, Louis, I says, cut it all off. Just cut it off clean, just right to the scalp. Take it all off. Okay. So he just shaved it right off, slick as a billiard ball. And I didn't have a hair left on my head that is sticking out. And so, now this is about the 1st of July. Then on the 7th of July, the Japanese here, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 Japanese came. And they're always very official in everything they do, you know. Everything's official. So they stood right at attention and told us to stand at attention in front of them. There was Willie and Cecil and Herman and I. We stood there at attention in front of these Japanese officers. Then he read a Japanese off of a page about that long, all Japanese, read the whole thing. It has to be done that way because that's the official way to do it in Japan, whether you're American or whatever. So they read the Japanese first. Then after he read the Japanese, then one of them read in English that the next morning at 8 o'clock we had to be ready because the Japanese were going to be there. They're going to pick us up and put us in internment camp again, and we could take with us as much as we could carry. And every one of us had to be ready. So this meant getting rid of all our stuff, getting rid of all our excess junk, anything we had, giving it to all our friends. We had a rice can. I had advised the friends to have extra rice. In case there's a shortage, have rice on hand. You don't know what's going to happen. If you have it, you're fine. If you don't have it and there comes a shortage, then you're stuck. So I had encouraged them to have it. We had it too. We had a rice can about that high, about that big around, and it was full to the top of rice. Well, that night we delivered all that rice to our friends around, got rid of it all. And then a whole lot of other stuff. We got rid of that stuff. Then the next morning we were ready to travel. I think we worked on that until midnight that night. We weren't supposed to be out at night, you know, but we did go out at night. So the next morning, our friends turned up there. Man, a whole pile of them, almost as many as we've got here, to see us off. And the women were crying and one thing. And I was playing the monkey because I didn't like to see them all crying, so we kind of had it kind of lively around there. And we climbed into this old 6x6 and waved them goodbye, and we were gone. They took us down to Santo Tomas internment camp. And they had us pile all our luggage in a big pile there. And they told us, now, you're not to go near your luggage. You're to leave it alone. Absolutely, you don't touch it. And here's the luggage piled in a big pile. And my box was there. This was a box about that long and about that high and about that wide. Had a hasp and a lock on it. Hinges, hasp and a lock. And this is what I had my stuff in. Just a wooden box. It had been a grocery box in a store. You know how they used to handle groceries? That's the way they used to get it. So we just went out and got a grocery box and made my box. Well, I put my money in that thing too. And so now, here we are. We're in this camp. And we don't know what's going to happen to us, but they said they had to go through our luggage. And you're to leave your luggage alone. You're not to touch it. And so there's that whole pile of luggage. Then here's a whole row of Japanese officers sitting over here at a table, and there's a space in between here. Now, I got to worrying about that money in that box. I just thought, no, I sure don't want to lose that, and I don't want to get in trouble over it. I wonder what's the best thing to do. I decided I'll go over and flip the lid of that box open and pretend just ignorant. I don't know anything about what they've said. I'm ignorant. And I'll just go over there and flip the lid of that box open, and I'll reach down there and find that and just take it and stick it in my pocket. And I'll do it right in front of them so they know I'm not hiding anything. And just right in the open. Okay. I walked over there, and I opened up my box. I leaned over, and I found what I wanted. Here's these officers all watching me, and I just took it out of there and put it in my pocket. And when I put that in my pocket, they all simultaneously yelled at me. And then one of those fellas came over. He wanted that. Well, I took it, and I opened it up, and I put some tablets out to show him, tablets, put them back in, put the lid on. I couldn't speak Japanese, but I tried to tell him that that's for my stomach. Well, he took the bottle. He went over to this first Japanese over here. He handed the bottle to him, and he unscrewed the lid, looked at it, dumped some of the tablets out, looked at them, put them back in the box. Passed it to the next guy. He did the same thing. Looked at it, passed it to the next guy, and went down through all six of those fellas. And so there's no use getting excited. I just waited. Pretty quick, the last fella, he looked in it, dumped some out, put them back, put the lid on it, handed it back to the soldier. Soldier brought it back to me. I put it in my pocket. Well, if I'd have been caught and they knew that had money in it, it'd probably cut my head off. I don't know. But anyway, now the next thing was to examine your luggage, and you had to identify yourself with your luggage. All right, come my turn, and this little old Japanese, he was a broad-shouldered fella, heavy-set fella. He looked at me, he said, you American soldier. He saw my bald head, and he figured I had gotten out of a prison camp someplace, and my head had been shaved. You American soldier. No, I says, I'm a civilian. You American soldier. No, I'm a civilian. You American soldier. And he's insistent that I was an American soldier. No, I'm a civilian. You American soldier. You American soldier. You American soldier. And pretty quick, I says, I got passport. He says, you got passport? Yes. He says, you get him. Okay. I put down my box, found my passport, and handed it to him, and he opened it up. Okay. I got through that one. Well, I don't know anybody else that had any problem that day. There was 500 of us picked up, and I think I was the only one that had any problem. But I went through it anyway. Well, then they put us all in that gymnasium we'd been put in before. There were 500 of us. Now we were men, women, and children, all missionaries. The women, they had one side of the restrooms, and we had the other side. And we went to bed. We didn't know what was going to happen, but we went to bed on the cement floor that night. We had our stuff, of course, along with us this time. And 2 o'clock in the morning, they come and rouse us all out. They wakened us up, turned all the lights on, and here they gave everybody some bread, a pandesal they call it. Gave everybody one pandesal, and then they gave everybody one hard-boiled duck egg. Well, I like those duck eggs. My, they were good. I didn't know at that time. I'll tell you, I learned. I didn't know at that time, but I'm allergic to duck eggs. I'm allergic to hard-boiled eggs. I don't eat any deviled eggs. I don't eat any hard-boiled eggs. I'll tell you what it does to me. I just make me bilious, and I just vomit, and I have enough fun. But I didn't know what the trouble was. I didn't know that was causing it. I'll tell you how I learned. This is jumping up a ways. After the war was over, I used to ride the train from Manila to Rosales. And every time I did, I'd buy me one of those duck eggs. I really liked them. And every time I did, I got sick, and I couldn't figure that train ride. Sure is a fright of a thing. I get sick every time. And then finally one day I said, I wonder if it's something I'm eating. And then finally I decided I'm not going to eat those duck eggs. I'm going to see if that had anything to do. And I didn't eat the duck eggs anymore, and I didn't get sick anymore. So, all right, I'm off of duck eggs. But I didn't know this at this time. And now then, I'll tell you the story about our train ride. We had to be down at the train station at 6 o'clock, and we had to be We're supposed to be in the train and ready to go in a little while. So, all right, 8 o'clock, the train pulled out. Now, we only had 40 miles to go. But it took from 8 o'clock in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon to make the 40 miles. Now, this is the way the train worked is just like they used to talk about the Arkansas train. It went so slow that it had to back up to whistle for the next station. Well, that's about how slow this was. But I was sick as a dog. I was sick as a dog, I tell you. And it was so sick that the Japanese had pity on me. And he took me over to a little store when the train stopped so that I could buy a soda pop to quiet my stomach. Well, considerate of him anyway. Well, we didn't get in until about 4:30. Then they said we had to wait until we were appointed a place to stay. Well, we waited and waited and waited, and here it's beginning to get dark. Well, finally, we just all went for a barracks, found a barracks, because we figured we've got to sleep someplace tonight. And we went to a certain barracks. We went to barrack 17, cubicle 1, I think it was. And Herman and Cecil and Willie and myself, and there's where we slept. Well, that became our quarters. And wherever we went that night, that was our quarters. It wasn't assigned, but that was it. And in our barracks, there were mostly single men. But anyway, then I should jump up a ways to... you want me to quit, don't you? Goodness, it's after 9 now. Well, all right. We come up to... Let's come up to September 21st. This was America's first air raid over the Philippines, in our area anyway. And it was on a Sunday at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we could hear the explosions in the distance, and we could see against a backdrop of white clouds little specks in the sky, and we could see the anti-aircraft puffs. We didn't know what was going on, but we knew it was an American raid. It was the first time we'd seen airplanes, American airplanes, for a long time. We hadn't seen airplanes for a long time. Hadn't actually seen an airplane, American airplane, since the Japanese shot them all down that first week of the war. We hadn't seen another American airplane. All right, we knew something's going on. There's a raid, and we knew this is the Americans. They're coming back. I should go back a little ways. Well, no, it's just still to come. All right. I'll tell you what. I got a hold of the history of the war, the Marine account of the history of the war. And you know what I found out about what happened on that day? The Americans made a raid. It was an aircraft carrier strike. It must have been 2 or 3 aircraft carriers. I don't know how much. But they knocked out... They destroyed 405 Japanese airplanes and sunk 103 ships that day. Now, that was the Pearl Harbor, wasn't it? That was the way America was coming back. 103 ships they sunk and knocked down, they destroyed 405 Japanese airplanes, besides others that they couldn't say for sure. But they said this was the sure number. Well... I didn't know what all this amounted to, but I told the boys this day, I said, you know what? I says, the next thing that's going to happen now that the Americans have started to come back, they're going to cut our rations. And they'll cut it down and cut it down and cut it down to where we've got practically nothing. And I said, we've got to do something about it. Now, I said, right over there in the corner of that Japanese kitchen, there's a little warehouse where they've got their rice stored. They've got piles of rice in there, sacks of rice. There's no guard in that building. And I told the boys, I'm going over there, and I'm going to take something with me to fill it up with rice, and I'm going to bring it over here and put it in my box. My box is about that long, about that high, about 15 inches high, 15 inches wide. And I said, I'm going to fill my box. Willie was not in the room at the time. And Cecil and Herman were there. And Herman says, I'll go with you. And Cecil says, you can use my pillowcase for a bag. And I told Herman, I said, look, I said, we're not going to carry but just a little bit each time because we don't want it to be too obvious what we're doing. And it was after lunch when most people would be taking a nap, and even the Japanese would be taking a nap, siesta. So, all right, we wandered off over there, and we wandered back, and we wandered over there again, and wandered back. No one would really know, and I don't think anybody ever did know what we were doing. And we filled that box with rice. Well... Then later on, You know, we'd been butchering animals in the camp. And we butchered animals up to a certain point, about, I think, maybe in October, or maybe it was into November, maybe October. And then they brought us, instead of butchering them, they brought us animals that had already been killed, and it was horses. Well, some of the people complained. And you know what happened? They brought us no more meat, either horse meat or none. And they could have just as well kept their mouths shut. Horse meat's better than none, but we got none after that. Well, on the, it was about the 14th of November, I saw a dog coming out of the Japanese kitchen with a big bone. But it was just a bone, bare bone, been cooked already, all the meat taken off of it. And I told the boys, I said, you know, there's marrow in that bone. And dog could never get it out, he's just a little dog. Well, she'd go get it. All right, I followed the dog till he laid down. I got the bone. I rushed him. The mistake I made was I didn't get the dog. More meat in the dog than there was on the bone. Well, then we move up to January 7th. Now, just about this time or a little before this time, I was standing out in front of the barracks. And by this time, the Japanese had cut our rations considerably. I was standing out in front of the barracks and a whole bunch of fellows leaning against the wall of the barracks. And a Japanese come up toward the barracks. And he addressed me. And he says, in good English, he says, what do you think of the war? Now, these Japanese that were in the internment camp there, for the most part, had been civilians in the Philippine Islands before the war started. They were not military men. And they were businessmen. And they didn't want to get involved in war, but they were in it. They drafted everybody into that war. Let me tell you how it worked. I knew a young fellow that was half Japanese. His father was an American. Kind of interesting. They forced this fella into the Japanese service, and he had to work in the Meralco, which was the Manila Electric plant. And the Manila Electric plant had Japanese soldiers in it. They had the files. They had everything in there. And so he worked there. Well, he went poking through their files, and he picked out things that he wanted to read. He'd take them home at night and take them back the next day. And so this is why we were free in the city. And he'd go and he'd get books that told all about American airplanes and Japanese airplanes, and we'd go over these books at night. He and I'd read these books. And but this fellow, he was a Japanese in appearance, but he was an American. And we'd read these books. You see what I'm talking about? Well, a lot of those Japanese were forced into service in our camp, but they were Japanese, but they were civilians. Well, this Japanese came up and he said, what do you think about the war? Well, I said, how do I know anything about the war? I says, you don't let us have radio. We don't have any newspaper. I says, we don't know anything about the war. I says, where are the Americans? He says, they're on Leyte. Well, the Leyte wasn't too far away, but I says, oh, very far. No, he says, very close. Well, he was wondering what we were thinking about it. Well, about this time, these fellas began to heckle. And they said, ask him who the president of America is. We didn't know. We had no idea. We hadn't heard yet. It was after the election, but we didn't know who the president was. Well, so he just turned and walked away. When he saw those guys were getting into it, well, he just walked away. If they'd left it alone, I might have got some information out of him. He had already given me a little. But I had to be satisfied with what I got. That was the last of that. But on January 7th, now by this time, I had volunteered to be night watchman. Now, in our camp, we had a government that worked this way. The Japanese said, you govern yourselves, then the person that breaks the law or the rules, he gets penalized, and you'll be sure he's penalized. But if you don't do that, we penalize the whole camp. Now you can suit yourself. So all right, we established a central committee, and they were the governing body of our camp, and they were all, I'll tell you, a big lot of our men came from the American embassy, a whole lot of them that were in there. There were 1,500 people in that camp before we came, 500 missionaries added to it. And a lot of them were men of high position with the U.S. government before. Now they're in our camp. So, all right, we had our central committee, and we had the regulations and orders and laws. Everybody was supposed to have camp duty. Well, I'd had camp duty all the time, and generally, a lot of times we had two camp duties because some people wouldn't take it. For instance, the Catholic priests, they wouldn't take camp duty. They figured that they'd just take it easy and they'd live longer. Well, they didn't gain our respect that way. But anyway, I took Camp Dewey of being night watchman. Now, it's a funny thing, being night watchman. The idea of being a night watchman is to keep people from stealing from one another. We didn't have anything to do with guarding the camp. But it's to keep people from stealing from one another. But we had to carry a lantern wherever we went so you can tell how secret it was. And we had to pay homage to the Japanese and respect them when we came to them. And this was an order. We had to carry the lantern. Well, I was on duty the morning of the 7th of January when the Japanese came and they told us who were on duty that we're leaving the camp. We're leaving the camp. It's going to be your camp. We're getting out of here. And it's your camp from now on. Well, I'll tell you what it was. They knew MacArthur was coming. And they had the idea that MacArthur will land in the southern end of the island of Luzon. He'll land in the southern end of the island of Luzon. Now, this is Luzon Island, but it's a long island, and he'd land way down here in the south, and he'd march north. Well, what the Japanese had done, they had fixed gun positions. They had fixed gun positions on the all along the roads, and they're all their gun portals pointing south so that they would be prepared for MacArthur when he landed. Well, MacArthur was a strategist, one of the greatest strategists that ever lived. Now, our camp is right here at the foot of this Laguna de Bay. This is Manila. This is Manila Bay. Here's where our camp is. All right? On the 7th of January, they told us they were leaving the camp. Now, they figured that what he will do, he'll come in at the south, and he'll march north, and he'll take everything as he goes. And so these fellows figured they're going to flee the camp and run to the north. They weren't military. So, on the 7th, they took off. They left the camp. We're left scot-free, absolutely scot-free, the whole camp, the whole thing. So what are we going to do? We had to notify the Central Committee as to what had happened. So the Central Committee called a meeting. We're going to meet at 6 o'clock, have a camp meeting. So they got somebody had an American flag. I don't know who it was. They got a bamboo pole and hoisted the American flag, and these goofy politicians, they had political speeches out there for about an hour and a half or 2 hours, talking about liberty and how wonderful liberty was and all of this. Now, they said there may be some Japanese in the area. We have to bring the flag back down. So they brought the flag back down. Well, then, here we've got liberty. Well, now, I knew that the Japanese had a warehouse there that had rice in it. And I knew one of the men that was in the embassy. His name was George Gray. So I went to see George Gray. I said, George, I said, they've got that rice in that warehouse there. And I said, a contingent of the Japanese army could come in here and they could back their trucks up to the warehouse. They could load every bit of that rice up, walk off, and leave us high and dry. We wouldn't have a thing. I said, look, why don't you take and ration that rice to every man, woman, and child in the camp and make it so that they can't get it. There's no way for them to get it. I said, you know, he says, you've got an idea. He said, I never thought of it. He says, I'll bring it up at the meeting. So the next thing I heard about, there's a rice rationing. And they rationed that rice. Now, I was the one that sparked that. And they rationed that rice to every man, woman, and child in the camp, the half of it. And I think this was the wisest idea. They kept the half of it. So that if the Japanese came around looking, well, they would find some, but they wouldn't find it all. They wouldn't know where it was. And they wouldn't know whether there had been any. Well, okay, we're all set up. Now, they told the people, now, don't you trade your rice for anything with anybody. This is for your protection, and we'll call for it later on when it needs to be used for the camp, but you keep it. Well, instructions are good if they're followed, but some of these guys, you know, I'll tell you what they did. Some of them had been without cigarettes for a long time. They climbed over the fence and went downtown, swapped their rice for cigarettes. Stupid. They were hungry. Others, they swapped their rice for something to drink. Terrible. But after a while, the Japanese left on the 7th, and you know what happened? Now, here's what happened. MacArthur was a strategist. Instead of him landing in the south and coming this way, he sailed up the Lingayen Gulf, and he landed here and started south. All the gun positions were in the wrong position. And it meant that we were going to be last to be rescued instead of first. But anyway, that's the way it went. These guys that fled our camp, they ran into MacArthur up here. And then they turned around and fled for the south. And a week later, on the 14th, they came back to our camp, and they came back as mad as hornets. Just as mad as hornets. And they wanted everything back that had been taken out of their quarters. And they had told us when they left, it's all yours. Whatever you want, it's yours. It's yours. Well, they're Indian givers. You can understand their position. But anyway, we had in our camp a couple of hundred men that had been merchant marine, that had been left by their ships, and they didn't have a thing. So whenever they had a chance to lay hold on what the Japanese left, they laid hands on that, and they got what the Japanese left. So they had stuff for their own, blankets, mosquito nets, beds, what have you. And I even got a pair of shoes out of it. Well, so the Japanese came back in, and they were mad as hornets, and they wanted everything back that had been taken out of their quarters. Everything, absolutely everything. Well, they made us line up, and first of all, they searched our barracks with us in the barracks. And incidentally, I wore the shoes while they searched our barracks. And I sat on my rice box while they were searching the room. And they searched the room, and they didn't find anything. And we didn't really have that much. My shoes was the biggest thing, I suppose, that we had that belonged to them. Well, anyway, they weren't satisfied with that. They decided to take us all out of our barracks and make us stand out in the sun while they searched our barracks. And this made these merchant marine men, merchantmen, the fellows that worked for the merchant marine, it made them angry as could be, searching our barracks while we're not in the barracks. And finally, here we are, all standing out in the sun, and they just decided we're going to break ranks and go. We're not going to stand for it. And you know, the Japanese, they yelled and yelled and yelled, but they never fired a shot. Boy, if they'd have started firing, it had been bad. But they didn't fire a shot. And these guys just went back to their barracks, and it was a hard situation. Well, Japanese cut our rations way down now, clear down to the bone. We're getting 100 grams of rice a day. That makes about 400 calories on the chow line. But they didn't know that we had some of our own, of course. Now, I'll tell you what. The ration was so small that if you didn't have something extra, you'd starve to death. There was one old man, for instance, he had about 15 cans of corned beef. And he was figuring this as his extra stock. And he'd open a can ever so often, and he'd have corned beef. And you could eat off a can of corned beef, 4 or 5 days. It won't spoil that quick. It's got enough preservative in it to keep it. And it'd last that long. But somebody stole his corned beef, and that old man died of starvation. He was the one that died of starvation. Well, this is the way it went, and there's a few people died of starvation. Well, so now then we're going on this ration, very, very poor ration. Willie always said, if we've got rice, let's eat it. There's no use waiting for tomorrow. Just take it by faith and believe that it'll be all right. But I was the cook, and I rationed it. I wouldn't give them any more than just a ration. Every day, the same ration. And we cooked our rice, cooked it with a lot of water so that it was soupy. And it gave you more, and you actually get more out of the rice that way. But it's not as tasty. So, but we did it on purpose. And then we had this big garden, and we'd cook sweet potato leaves, that is the sprouts, as greens. And we had a big, big garden, and we just take down a row one day and back there another row the next day and down the next row the next day until finally we'd gone over the whole thing, and we'd start back up here again. And that way we had greens every day. All right, this is the way that it worked. Well, finally now we're up to the time when it's getting near the time of our rescue. So on the 22nd of February, at about 5 o'clock in the evening, 5:30, where a flight of P-38s came over. Maybe I better cut this off. A flight of P-38s came over, and right behind our camp was a mountain about 3,000 feet high, right here where that X is, 3,000 feet high, Mount McKeeling. And, you know, they started bombing the top of that mountain, and we could see them dive, and we could see the bombs fall, and they were tremendous big bombs. You could see them. And they made a real explosion. We didn't know what they were bombing, but it was up there on the top of that mountain. So, what did we do? Didn't do anything, just watch it. Well, we went to bed that night, and we didn't know what was going to happen. But the next morning, about 4 o'clock, we heard a rumble, and it sounded like airplanes, airplane engines. And I knew the sound of airplane engines. My ears were good those days. I could tell the sound of an airplane engine, a radial engine. I could tell those are airplane engines. I didn't know where it was coming from, but we could hear this, and it went on for quite a long while. Well, it turns out that these were radial engines, 250 horsepower engines, used in amphibious tanks. And these tanks were bringing paratroopers down and landing them on the beach to camp. This is Laguna de Bay. This is an inland lake, and it's 40 miles long, fresh water. Its only outlet is through the city of Manila in what's called the Pasig River into Manila Bay. And they came down, we were 15 miles behind the line, they came down in these amphibious tanks, and they let out about 150 American soldiers, paratroopers. First time, paratroopers were never used ordinarily this way, but that's the way they did. Well, now they had, let me tell you what their plan was to rescue us. And this is the day of our rescue. Their plan was to send those fellows, and they were to surround the camp during the night, and they weren't to fire any shot. They were to wait. Then they had it planned that there would be a caravan of trucks would come down by highway, and this is a kind of a mountainous area here. They'd come down by highway, and they would be the trucks that would take us out of the internment camp, and they'd haul us back. That's the way they'd get us out. Can you see that map all right? And then it was figured that there would be 9 C-47 airplanes come with paratroopers in them, and they'd jump. Well, we didn't know this, of course. Didn't know a thing about any of this. And besides that, there were going to be some boats come across here, and these would be guerrillas, Filipino guerrillas, and they were going to help out in the action. Well, let me tell you now what happened. The Filipino guerrillas got becalmed in the middle of the bay, and the Japanese stopped the truck caravan. And 7 miles from our camp was an encampment of 11,000 Japanese soldiers. And now they're starting this rescue action, and all the trucks have been stopped. And the paratroopers jumped. All right, now let me tell you, let me lead up to it so you get the thrill out of it that I got. We didn't know anything was happening. We didn't know a thing. We always had roll call at 6 o'clock in the morning. And the Japanese were as punctual as a Japanese train, and that's punctual, right on the dot. They just split hairs to make it so they're just exactly right. They were always out there for roll call. Before the roll call came, I always got my pot ready to cook rice in, because this is the rice that we cook for ourselves. The Japanese encouraged us to do this sort of thing, have our own garden, cook for ourselves. They didn't know whether we were cooking rice or what we were cooking. And so it wasn't anything out of the way. It wasn't something they wouldn't expect. They'd take us out into the jungle to cut wood for the camp kitchen, and we'd cut wood for ourselves, and that was allowed. So that's the way it went. And they'd also taken us on a tour down into a part of the camp that never got used. They had more barracks built than they ever used. And they said we could take materials out of that to improve our barracks, so we did that. And I found materials down there that I could make a stove with, so I made a stove. So we had a stove. Now, I'd always get this ready to cook before roll call. Then as soon as roll call was made, then I'd back and light the fire, and we'd start cooking. And we'd eat on that maybe twice that day, but we just cooked once. And you could do what you like. We divided it up evenly between the four of us, and it was up to you. You could save it, or you could eat it all at once. So this is the way we did it. Well, this morning we went out and we waited and waited and waited, and the Japanese didn't come. And they'd never been this way before. You know what was wrong. And we waited and waited. Well, finally we wandered back to our barracks and wondered what was the matter with the Japanese. Well, I stood looking out the window, and I see here comes some airplanes. These are C-47s. I knew planes. I could just spot a plane, tell what it was. C-47s. They're flying low, and there were three groups of them. Three in each group. Coming low. And then I saw a green smoke rise up out here. And boys, those planes, they got to that green smoke, and it was to be exact, 135 paratroopers jumped. A lot of times I said 150, but it wasn't that many. It was 135. 15 to each plane. 135 paratroopers jumped, and when they jumped, this is it. I knew that was our day. I didn't know, I hadn't known anything about it going to happen, but I knew this is the time. And sure enough, I jumped right to my pot to light the fire. And the bullets were flying every direction. As soon as those paratroopers jumped, the bullets started flying. And I thought, man, the Japanese are getting our paratroopers before they ever hit the ground. But it wasn't. It was our paratroopers that had come in by night, had surrounded the camp, and they were getting the Japanese. And they got the Japanese, they just got the Japanese just like that, a slick movement. And the paratroopers, pretty quick, they come, they put evidently firebombs into the Japanese quarters, as I don't know what, how, but they set the whole thing on fire, and the Japanese never came out of there. And pretty quick, they come running through the camp, and there were Filipinos came running in, guerrillas, and some of them weren't armed with nothing but a bolo knife, and the Americans were telling them, don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot. They were afraid they'd kill an American, you know. Some of them had guns. And so they told us to be ready in 20 minutes, be down in the athletic field. This was the agricultural branch of the University of the Philippines, and it was their agricultural college that we were in. So I jumped there to cook this rice, and the bullets just, you could see the treasure just going through the walls of those buildings. And so you'd know where there's a treasure, there's four or five other bullets going right along the same track. Well, the boys kept yelling at me to lay down. Well, I got down as low as I could get and still take care of that fire, stir the pot and put wood in it. And they were laying on the floor inside. Well, I told them, I said, you've got to eat. I said, we've got to have something to eat. You may have to march for 40 miles. You don't know what's going to happen today. We didn't know how we were going out of there. We had no clue as to how we were going to get out of there. So, all right. They told us that we were to be down the athletic field and load into the Amtrak. And this order had come through. You see, they'd changed the plan. We thought that was the original plan. We were to load into the amphibious tanks, and they'd haul us out. And they could carry about 50 men in one tank. Well, I cooked, so the boys were getting their stuff ready while I was cooking. Well, by the time I set the rice on the table, while they were, it didn't take them long to eat what they wanted, and they were gone. And they were saying, hurry, hurry, hurry. And I said, don't worry, I'll get there. Don't worry. And so I got my stuff ready, and then I sat down, and man, they hadn't eaten hardly anything. And man, I just had one good meal. I tell you, I really had one good meal. And then on that good meal, I got my box on my shoulder and started off down for the amphibian tank, and I walked past where the Japanese quarters were, and there's a big fence around it, Suwali fence. There was a guy there with a walkie-talkie, and there were Piper Cubs up above flying around, you know, observing. And I asked him, I said, where are all the Japanese? He said, they're in there. The whole thing was on fire. And so then I went down, climbed into one of those tanks, and the guy gave me I was the first one into the tank, and he gave me a chocolate bar, and I didn't care what tank I was in. It was all right, just as long as he'd get me out of there. And pretty quick, other people come loading in, and then the tanks, they have this door that closes up on the back, and they can carry jeeps, you know, or 4x4s of different kinds. And so this ramp closes up, and then they head out, and there they were, heading out. Well, I stood up to see if I could see the other boy. Where's Willie and Herman and Cecil? Where are these guys? And I looked and looked and looked. I looked at all the tanks that were down ahead, and I could see there were only four or five down there, and I didn't see them in any one of those tanks. And, well, where in the world did those fellas go? Then I looked behind. I looked back there. And there they were, about a half a dozen tanks behind. They were back there. I was out in the lead tank after all. Well, I was a kid, just a kid, you know. So I climbed out on the deck of that thing, and here's a driver here. You know, it looks like a manhole. There's another manhole here, and there's a driver in each side. Man, I had a beautiful perch there. I sat right there on the deck. The place where most of them were was down behind. I had a view, man. That was a beautiful view. I could just see everything. So, all right, we come down. That was 2 miles down to the shoreline, and there was a fellow down there with a walkie-talkie, and he was in touch with these Piper Cubs. And he was waving his arm. Go straight out, he says. And when we could hear what he was saying, well, that's what he said. These things make an awful lot of noise. And these Amtraks are big, big things. Well, all right, so we go straight out. I'm sitting on the deck of this thing. Boy, right out there riding, this is a great day. I tell you, it's a great day. And I'm riding on the deck of that thing, and then here we are out in the water. And then all of a sudden, out there, about 50 yards ahead of us, the water went up like that. And it was one of these mortar shells had hit from the shore. And there was a little protrusion out there, a little point we went going by, and those Japanese had us just about zeroed in. And what they'd do, they'd shoot a shell on this side, then they shoot a shell on that side, and the next time, be sure it's going to hit you. That's the way the Japanese were with their mortar shells. Well, boy, I poked that driver's head to get him to see what had happened. And of course, he could see the water. You see that something had happened out there. Told him, mortar shell. And they swung the thing out and went further out. Got out of range. And all the rest of them did. They didn't get a one of us. They all got out of range. Then they took us down, and they landed us on the shore. Got up there about 11 o'clock, I guess, that day. And then they had 6x6 trucks to haul us to the camp, and that camp was where Jack Angel Beck and Johnny Beck and Bud Myers were, three of our boys, and they were in the hospital unit that occupied that area. And Willie was in kind of bad shape, so that is, he's tired. He was older than we were. He was only 60-some. But anyway, he was older than the rest of us were, and we considered Willie an old man, and he was. But so Herman went and he talked to some of the officers to see if they couldn't get him in a little ahead so they wouldn't have to wait through all that. So they did. They got him in ahead. They got him in a vehicle that went off early. Herman and I didn't get into camp that night until 6 o'clock. And then they had chow line for us, and that was great. And I went through the chow line once, and that was pretty good, but it was pretty thin stuff. It was soup. It was good soup. I went back and went through again. And I went back and went through again. And I went through until I'd gone through six times. And I figured, well, that's pretty good. Well, I'll tell you what. In that camp, in a few days, those fellas couldn't figure out, what's the matter with these people anyway? It looks like we arrested 2,000 people. And they said, we're feeding an awful lot more than 2,000 people. An awful lot of people. So they took a count on how many went through the line, and they found out 7,000 people went through the line. But what they were doing, they were going through three times. Oh, so they decided they'd increase the ration and give us a little more to eat. They were afraid they'd make us sick. But they found out that the internees can reason and go back more than once. So they decided that they'd give us enough to take care of us. Well, Herman and I, we wanted to stay and take care of our friends. And Willie and Cecil left. Willie came back to the States, and Cecil went back to New Zealand. And Herman and I stayed that next year and worked missions. Finally got our liberty to do so and went to live with the friends. And during that year was when Ligaya Sanyas, who was here for convention, professed that year. Then the girl that's been in Hong Kong the last two or three years, Ruby Eusebio, her mother professed that year. She wasn't born. Ruby wasn't born yet. But she'd been preaching in Hong Kong. And so the year wasn't wasted, and we were able to look after our friends. We felt very thankful we did that. One day I was in the marketplace, and some of our friends didn't know that we were in the country, and Herman and I were in the marketplace. Here, a little old lady, Mrs. Miso. She saw us. She grabbed hold of us and she began to cry. Oh, the tears just run. She was so happy. She was so happy to see us. They had lost everything. And she didn't know what had ever happened to us. But she was just so happy to see us. She just, you couldn't. And then the Filipinos all around couldn't understand, what's all this all about? Well, she was happy to see us and we were happy to see her. There was another instance where Herman and I, we wanted to go and visit the folks in Cavite, and we didn't know where they were, but we wanted to go visit them. Well, we had to go around, a long way around, because now there was a bridge that was knocked out, and we had to go a long way round. We're walking down another road, and here we were, Herman and I, swinging along down this road, and all of a sudden a cry, "Leo, Leo, Leo, Leo!" And we turned around, and here was Maria Roncal. Maria and Francisco Roncal. And this woman, I'll tell you what she had done. When she heard Santo Tomas had been liberated, she thought we were in there. So she had taken a cartela, that's a horse-drawn rig, and she'd taken food, all kinds of food, and she'd gone in there looking for us. Looked and looked and looked and looked, and of course we weren't there, we were 40 miles south in another prison camp. But she came back then disappointed and feeling very badly. But here now, this day, we're walking down this highway, and she was the one. She saw us, "Leo, Leo, Leo," she says. And they brought us to the house, and man, before you could say scat, she'd cut off the heads of half a dozen chickens, and she had rice cooking, and my goodness, you couldn't do anything but just sit down and have a meal. And we had a meal with them. I'm not sure about what we stayed the night at. I can't remember the details. But then we wanted to go to Cavite, and the bridges were blown up, and we couldn't go direct, and there was a way of getting a dugout bunka, just a dugout a boat made from a log, and the guy would row us across to Cavite, and we paid him. So he rowed us across there, and we went to visit our friends out there. And some of those friends, they were suffering from malnutrition. It was terrible. Some of you have met this De Castro boy, what's his name, up in L.A. Anyway, he's a short fellow. Well, he was so emaciated from malnutrition, it was terrible. But anyway, that's just the way it was. And eventually, Hubert and Howard came back after about a year, and then we came back to California. And that was an interesting trip. I wonder if I should share with you a little bit about it. Oh, we'll let it go some other time.
I don't mind. We have 15 minutes more, or 10.
Is it that late? Goodness. Midnight. Midnight.
You have 15 minutes. You can make it 15. Don't be coming.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, we got on a troop ship, and we were coming back. And there were about 50 men in one room there, and it was really a hard situation. The Negroes had control of the thing, and they gambled all night long and kept the lights going all night, and it was a fright. So one night I just decided, I'm going to put a stop to this. So I went and got an MP, and I brought him down there and told him what the trouble was, and he quieted the thing down. Well, then after the MP left, a great big burly Negro came walking over to my place, and he said, "You called that MP, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I sure did." He said, "We're going to cut you up and feed you to the sharks." I said, "Okay, mister." I said, "Everybody in this room heard you say that. Now, if I stub my toe or skin my nose, you know who's to blame." He walked away and left me alone then. Well, then, when we come back to the Golden Gate, man, these hardened old GIs. I tell you, the tears run pretty freely. Everybody was glad to see that old Golden Gate. And I was too. We hadn't had any idea what would happen before we got back, but a lot had happened. And now we were back. That was a great day. Yeah. Beg pardon?
How many years did you have?
Well, I had left in 40, and now it was 46. Yeah. And we were liberated February 23rd, 1945. And it was just about a year later. Yeah. And the work has increased in the Philippines greatly, and there are 14 pairs of workers on the island of Luzon, and I think 7 pairs of workers down in the Mindanao, down in the southern area. Altogether, there are, how many are there? There are more than 40 native workers, and there's about maybe 20 foreign workers, which makes for a good, and they've got, it's been an open field and a fruitful field, and been wonderful. enjoyed my time there and felt very badly when I left it to go to Guam. Felt badly when I left Guam to come over here. Now here I am. So. Beg pardon?
You probably know that one of those paratroopers, that L. Bill McCain, he lives over in Arizona.
Is that right?
The paratroopers are top good, right?
Uh-huh. I just don't know too much about any of them.
Huh?
I don't know too much about any of them,
yeah,
no.
Well, he still lives over there. He was at San Pete a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
He's not protesting, but his wife was protesting.
What's his name?
L. Bill McCain.
Oh, he was out here to San Pete.
13 years ago, so he came over for convention, but he doesn't protest.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
How long were you free in the city of Manila?
We were free in the city of Manila almost 2.5 years. Now then, about that box I had the rice in, Willie never learned how we got that rice, and we never told him because we figured that Willie would be conscience stricken and think that we shouldn't have done it. But we figured that Willie needed to have rice in his stomach, so we didn't tell him. I didn't say anything to him until I was at Casa Grande Convention one time, and I was showing him the pictures that I've got in this book, and showed him the picture of the time of the box and all. And he looked at it. I says, Willie, did you ever know where that rice came from that was in that box? Well, he says, I suppose that you brought that rice into camp with you. I told him no, and I told him the story of how we got it. Shook his head. He said, you saved our lives. Well, there are times when I almost got him into Dutch, but I did say maybe something like that. There's a picture here that if you'd like to just have a peek at it, there's the box. This is our quarters. These are pictures that I drew. And this is a picture made on the 11th of,